Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Can building big buffers against risk make us less safe? Greg Ebb, chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal, argues it can and often does, whether the realm is flooding or football helmets or banking. Is he right? This hour on Point, safety, risk, and the way we live now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you feel too protected from risk or too vulnerable? Joining me now from New York is Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. His new book is Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Greg Ipp, welcome. It's wonderful to have you here.
It's great to be here, Tom.
All right. I'm trying to figure out exactly where you're coming from. Are you in the Jeb Bush stuff happens camp? Don't try to buffer your life because stuff happens.
I think that I went through a bit of a personal journey myself. I would say that 20 or 30 years ago, when I first got into the journalism business, I was of the let's not try too hard to save ourselves from our own mistakes because stuff does happen. And then after 20 years of watching the economy, I was really impressed by the good job that the Federal Reserve did in terms of keeping the economy on an even keel, keeping inflation low, keeping unemployment low, and making sure that if there was a problem, whether it was the East Asia crisis or the 1987 stock market crash, that they would get us out of trouble. So I was as shocked as everybody else when the global financial crisis happened in 2007 to 2008. And since then, I've been studying and researching it a lot, and I am more and more convinced that it was the belief by everybody, including myself, that the Fed had solved all those problems that allowed people to become more complacent, take on more risk, and allow different types of risk to emerge in places where we didn't even think to look. And so I come to this uneasy conclusion, Tom, that it is right that we try to deliver our to create a more stable and safe economy and environment, but there will always be unintended consequences.
Banking is maybe a highly sophisticated, articulated version of this tale that you tell. Definitely, that's where there's a lot at stake. But let's back up if we could. Give us some simpler examples with which you're making your point here, Greg, about buffers against vulnerability and their potential downside.
Sure. Well, it's a natural thing that we want to protect ourselves, whether it's in their economy or the environment. But let's look, for example, at the history of forest fighting, which actually has a lot in common with the history of the Federal Reserve. The U.S. Forest Service and the Federal Reserve were both created approximately a century ago during the Progressive Era, when our overriding philosophy was mankind can control the chaos of the free market economy and the chaos of our environment. And so forest fighters said we must put out all wildfires. Well, it took some decades for them to figure out this was actually a mistake. We now know that wildfire has a very valuable purpose in nature. It essentially cleans out a lot of the fuel and the dead brush on the forest floor. It kills off the weaker trees and allows the stronger trees to survive. The legacy of decades of fire suppression is denser trees and more fuel. So when fires do happen, they're bigger fires. In the last decade or so, we've had a lot more of these mega fires. This year could go down on as the worst year forever on record for wildfire. It is definitely the case that a warmer climate has contributed to a longer fire season. But at the same time, all that fire suppression over the years has also left forests with more fuel. So that's an example of how, in our attempt to make the environment safer for us, we have this unintended consequence of storing up trouble for later.
And yet, I'm still left trying to figure out where exactly you're going, if it's a libertarian view you've come around to. A libertarian view might say, let the forests burn and let the fossil fuels burn. Let everything burn. And, you know, was it fire suppression or was it drought and climate change that made all that happen? Should we be actively more interested in reining in the risk of climate change so that we don't have an entire West ready to go up in flames?
So here's a very tough choice. And I actually, while I was researching my book, I actually interviewed a lot of people who've had to face these very difficult choices. I interviewed, for example, the guy who was the superintendent of Yellowstone in 1988, the year they had those terrible fires. And they had made a decision that year to let some lightning that had started fires, allow those fires to burn. But it turned out to be a very dry summer. And by the end of the summer, it was the worst fires in Yellowstone's history. It's a very tough decision for somebody faced with this dilemma. Do I allow something like a fire or a bank failure, for that matter, to take its course? Or do I so that we can reinforce our awareness of that danger and take the appropriate precautions? Or do I intervene now to prevent a wider conflagration? And I suppose where I come down on this is as follows, Tom, is that you have to make a judgment in each case, which is how much can we minimize the catastrophic consequences while allowing a natural amount of risk-taking and danger to occur that makes us stronger? My phrase is that we should allow small disasters and small accidents to happen to make us stronger against the big ones. So, for example, in the case of fires, you want to be able to allow as many small fires to burn as possible. One way you do that is requiring homeowners who live near the forest to have a perimeter of defensible space around their homes so that when the forest nearby burns, it doesn't threaten the house and the fire service doesn't have to go in there and put the fire out. And I would make an analogy to the banking system as well. The equivalent of space when it comes to the banks is make them hold more capital so that if they make a big mistake, they have a rogue trader, for example, or they lend a lot of money to risky companies and they lose a lot of money, that money is absorbed by the shareholders' equity. It doesn't cause the bank to fail.
This is not just theoretical stuff. If you make it political, it comes down to policy, and all of our fates get bound up in it. Let's stick with the straightforward examples for a minute. We'll take it back to banking and some of the bigger social policies. You look at football helmets, Greg.
Right. So football has always been a violent sport. I think it was in the early 1900s that Teddy Roosevelt called all the university presidents together and told them to do something about the fact that kids were actually dying playing this sport. By the 1940s, hard helmets had been introduced in the game of football. And what happened was that coaches discovered that when the players wore these hard helmets, they could hit other players harder. And they taught them to spear the opposing opponent by putting their head down and ramming them. What they discovered was that while the helmets prevented some injuries like broken noses and broken teeth, it led to an increase in things like broken necks and quadriplegias because the hitting other players with your head actually puts a lot of pressure on the spine. Eventually, the authorities clamped down on that and they banned spearing in football. But it is still the case that the epidemic of concussions that you have in football is in part a consequence of the fact that players feel so well protected by these modern helmets. The question then becomes, well, do we then tell players, don't wear helmets? And some people have actually suggested that, like Mike Ditka, who was the Super Bowl winning coach with the Chicago Bears some years ago. Well, the problem is, as I've talked to a few experts on this, is that you probably would have fewer types of some injuries, but you would have more types of other injuries, like perhaps skull fractures. So there is no easy way out, but there has to be an awareness that when you protect yourself with something, whether it's a football helmet or, for example, anti-lock brakes on a car, you might be causing people's behavior to change and to be aware of that and to take that into consideration.
The helmet looks like an obvious element of safety on the football field, but, hey, don't take it from a Wall Street Journal commentator. Here is Mike Ditka, the great Chicago Bears. This is not a long time ago. This is 2010, talking about football helmets.
And the helmet's a weapon. It is a weapon. Now, whatever they want to say, I understand it's a necessity, but it's a weapon. When you compare that helmet today to the helmet I wore, you would laugh. The helmet we wore was a plastic with a little padding inside. Some of them had suspensions, but most of it was just padding inside with a single face mask or two bars, that's all. The helmet is a problem.
Greg Ipp writes it all up in his new book, Foolproof. And, Greg, you talk about fodder for forest fires. This looks like fodder for libertarian, laissez-faire Americans who want to say, back off government, back off rule and regulation makers, live in, just let it rip, let it go.
No, that's not the argument that I'm making here. What I think is that all of us, when we try to think through these difficult questions, have to step back from the ideological battles and try and be as impartial as we can. And I'm a big believer in research and actually measuring the results. So let me give you a good example. What can we do about the burning to help the climate? Well, Back in the 80s, or the 1970s and the 1980s, there were a lot of concerns about the safety of nuclear power because of the accident at Three Mile Island and then later Chernobyl. And the result of that is it became very difficult and very costly to build new nuclear power plants. Well, researchers, including some who are very concerned about global warming, have concluded that nuclear power has actually contributed a lot to reducing dangerous emissions of particulates and soot and have been and can be a big part of the solution to global warming. By making it so difficult, because we're worried about the very small chance of a nuclear power accident, by making it so difficult to open nuclear power plants, we have inadvertently made life less safe because of other risks such as particulate matter. If I could give you one interesting little case study, I think it was in the early 1980s that the Tennessee Valley Authority was required to temporarily take a couple of their power nuclear generating stations offline because of problems with safety. And a scholar decided to figure out what happened when as a result, the burning of fossil fuels went up to compensate for that loss of power. He found that in the affected counties, there was an increase in the incidence of low birth weight babies. So this is one way of saying is that when you clamp down on one type of risk, if you actually overcompensate because you're afraid of one type of risk, you might be actually increasing risks in another part of life. So that's why I say we have to be kind of grown up about this and ask ourselves tough questions. Measure this. We have a lot of research available to us. Is it worth it to us to actually do we actually make ourselves safer doing these things? And I would argue that in the case of nuclear power, when Germany or Japan or Switzerland, for that matter, decides to take nuclear power offline because of their concern about the consequences of the Fukushima accident, they may in the long run be making their people less safe because it leads to the more burning of fossil fuels.
We want a perfect world or something closer to it, but trying to get there may raise its own issues. This is interesting. It has all kinds of policy, maybe political implications, whether Greg Ipp means it that way or not, certainly in the national conversation. The new book is Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Greg Ipp is chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal, Greg Ipp, about his new book, Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. Greg Ipp joins us from New York. Examples all around. Fire all over the West. Here's Mark Giladucci, director of California's Office of Emergency Services. More than 8 million acres have burned in wildfires so far this year.
The Valley Fire in Lake County will be one of the top 20 most devastating fires we've seen in California. The fire season itself has probably been the most extreme that I've seen in my 30 years.
Did we try too hard not to have fires or pay too little attention to climate change that might be bringing drought there? What about dams? The water comes in South Carolina. Pressure builds up on the dams. People live below those dams. They don't always hold out. Here was ABC News' Alex Perez reporting on the threat and the response of South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley.
In South Carolina tonight, all eyes on at least 18 dams that could burst under pressure.
The next 36 to 48 hours is going to be volatile. So what we'll tell you is don't let the sunshine fool you.
Not ideological, Greg Ipp says, but you can easily imagine this going right into arguments. Here was Jeb Bush at a town hall in Nevada in September.
I know something else. The idea that you can solve every problem with another rule doesn't work. It is stifling our ability to rise up.
Or in another South Carolina setting, Jeb Bush saying stuff happens after the school shootings in Roseburg, Oregon. Greg Ipp joins us from New York. Tom Herschel will come and join us in a minute from Cornell. He's looking at the big picture here when it comes to risk and how Americans live, but callers as well. Justin, Winona, Minnesota. Justin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, what do you think?
I think that as a people, we have to really think about this in an adult fashion. You know, are we creating safety measures just so we can behave irresponsibly or make a buck? You know, that's really what it comes down to. So at what expense? You know, that's what we have to ask ourselves about these safety measures. Yes, some safety measures like anti-lock brakes. Great idea. Recently, they discovered a possible way to alter our genes so that we can eat what we want. I'm not sure if that's a good idea.
Even anti-lock brakes, Greg Yip has some issues with. Let me hold the anti-lock brakes for a second, Justin, and get one more call here, if I may. Herman, calling from Bloomington, Illinois, my beautiful hometown. Herman, very glad to hear from you. You're on the air.
Yes, I was involved in auto safety for State Farm for the better part of 40 years. And early on in the auto safety arena, people were concerned about making cars safer or even making the highway safer, saying that, well, if you make cars safer, people are going to drive more dangerously. Well, all of the rules that we have on auto safety, for safer cars, safer highways, seatbelt laws, that has brought down the death rate by somewhere between two-thirds and also the absolute number of people dying on the highway has gone down from 53,000 to about 32,000, roughly about the same number we kill with guns, which is a whole other question. So it absolutely has not made people drive more recklessly, as people were saying, if you have safer cars.
Yeah.
So there are good rules, and hundreds of thousands of people are alive today because of all the things we've done on auto safety.
Herman, stick with us for a second, if you would, Herman. Stick with us there. Greg, yep, this sounds like a pretty strong challenge to your thesis from someone at State Farm Insurance, where they calculate these things and follow them and pay out on them for a living, for a business. He says, come on, all of our safety precautions on the road have paid off very handsomely.
Well, this is a fascinating story, and I investigated it, the history of automobile safety and the counterarguments that were made against automobile safety innovations. And I found that the story was very interesting and complex. The bottom line is, the caller is absolutely right. We have significantly reduced road deaths and accidents, and there's no question that many safety technologies and requirements have played a role there. In the 1970s, for example, there was a concern advanced by Sam Peltzman, an economist at the University of Chicago, that people who wore seatbelts drove faster and they killed more pedestrians. Well, it took quite a few years of very careful research, but we now know that that is not true, is that seatbelts do not result in more pedestrian deaths, and mandatory seatbelt laws do save lives. But when you look at other forms of technology, it's not so obvious, and that's why I bring up the case of anti-lock brakes. There have been exhaustive studies done on this, and we cannot find clear proof that they reduce accidents. And I actually asked this question to the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety, why the benefits of safety belts do not seem to transfer to anti-lock brakes. And I got the following answer, is that whether a safety technology affects the benefits to safety depends on how it feeds back to the driving task. People wearing seatbelts aren't really aware of the fact that they're wearing seatbelts, and it doesn't make them feel they can drive differently. But if you put them in a car with anti-lock brakes or studded snow tires or a variety of other things that give them more control over the car, they may drive faster, or they may drive in conditions when they might not otherwise have driven. It doesn't necessarily mean that you lose all the benefit of that technology, but you do lose some of the benefit. So this takes me back to my point. And I do think that some libertarians argue against rules and safety technology more out of a political philosophy that the government shouldn't tell them what to do. A good example is motorcycle helmets. The literature is unambiguous that motorcycle helmet laws save lives. But a lot of people think that people should be allowed to ride motorcycles without a helmet and risk their own neck. That's not really a safety or an empirical question. It's a political philosophy question. And those are tough questions that society has to decide for itself. But some libertarians have put forth the argument that, well, people who wear motorcycle helmets will then just drive around through different states to avoid having to wear them. That doesn't seem to hold up to research. Now, a different question arises with bicycle helmets, because a variety of studies have suggested that if people are required to wear bicycle helmets, they're less likely to ride bicycles. And that means they may not get the cardiovascular benefits of riding bicycles. Moreover, it means that there will be fewer bicycles on the street. And there's some research that suggests that drivers are more careful when there are more cyclists out there. So again, I sort of return to this spot that I try to take the ideology out of the question. I wouldn't consider myself either a libertarian or an anti-libertarian. But what I do believe we really need to do is research the question and find out what does the best of the empirical data tell us is the best answer here.
One of those zones where it's hard to take the ideology out. Whatever you say will be picked up and used, maybe in the same spirit that you offer it, and maybe not. Greg Ipp is with us. His new book is Foolproof. Herman in Bloomington, thank you very much for your expertise. That was terrific. New Orleans, Chris is calling. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question or statement really has to do with the fact that there are biological equivalents to what Mr. Ipp is talking about. If you've heard of the principle of hormesis, it's basically the idea that a biological system, if exposed to small stresses, will be more adaptable to or more able to survive a larger stress down the line. And I just wanted to know what his opinion of that might be.
Chris, what is that called again? Hormesis? What did you say? I couldn't make it out.
Hormesis.
Great. Greg, have you got the biological parallel here?
Well, I'm not actually familiar with the term, but I'm familiar with the principle, and there is some truth to it. For example, area where I've looked at this is health and antibiotics. So when antibiotics first came out of the 1940s and 1950s, they were considered like a miracle drug because they could cure diseases that at that time had seemed like insoluble. For example, people who had severe burns as a result of accidents and fires. But within years of the original scientists who discovered antibiotics also worried that if people took too many of them, it would actually start to weaken their benefits because people would because it would lead to resistance strains through the principle of Darwinian natural selection. And indeed, within years of the spread of the introduction of antibiotics, we began to see resistant strains appear. And things like MRSA are now serious scourges in hospitals and communities. So it seems to be the case that if we were to accept being sick a little bit more often and not treating every germ with an antibiotic, we might in the end preserve the power of antibiotics and make them more powerful. And that's why the medical community has tried hard to reduce the overuse of antibiotics, for example, in livestock, where it's often administered to animals through their feed, to train doctors how to recognize conditions like sore throats that are probably viral and therefore are not responsive to antibiotics. The principle here is that don't overuse the tools that we have. Allow a little bit of background risk to take place so that the tools we have remain powerful for the times we really need them.
How much risk should we try to take out of life? It's a potent question. Greg Ipp writes it up in Foolproof. Greg, stand by there in New York. Tom Herschel joins us now from Ithaca, New York, professor of sociology at Cornell, director of the Population and Development Program there and coordinator of the program work team on poverty and economic hardship. He's co-author of Chasing the American Dream. Tom Herschel, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. I'd like to talk about poverty risk. It's one of the things that we came across in our book, Chasing the American Dream, is that we found that approximately 80% of American households, if you look over the life course of adults, encounter serious economic hardship, some form of impoverization. And there's a lot of research that says that there are very negative effects of that on the children in the family, on the adults. There are differences in life expectancy. So I think that this is one area where society really isn't doing very much right now. There is the risk at the upper level where people with high incomes could also lose their assets or have economic uncertainty as well. But I think if you just look at the bottom half of the distribution, you see an issue that's not really being addressed, which is growing poverty risk in the United States.
But let me ask you, Tom, does this, to you, look like, as a sociologist, look like the American problem, that we're not confronted in life with enough risk, that we're too cosseted and buffered these days as a people?
I think people do confront, that's sort of our finding, is that, for example, we followed a representative sample of the population. We followed cohorts of baby boomers and post-baby boomers, and we found that between 67% to 80% they were asset poor, which means they didn't have enough savings to last for 3 months, to survive on 3 months. So we see people are kind of on thin ice, the majority of American households. And social policy is kind of backing away from anti-poverty efforts right now. And I think that's a serious situation.
We're looking at risk and safety. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I mean, Greg Ipp, I have to say, in recent years, the theme has been more about risk. Tom Herschel looks at the impoverished or near impoverished, but a lot of middle-class Americans have felt, I think, more vulnerability than invulnerability in recent years. Very broadly speaking, how does your theme speak to that sort of generic vulnerability that that many in the country feel?
I think Tom is raising a very important point. He's absolutely right. There was a lot of research done about a decade ago that looked at what seemed on the surface like a paradox, which was that the overall economy had become more stable, as we talked about earlier on. We had fewer recessions. We had lower inflation. But if you actually dug down into the data, you found that the individual household's life had become more precarious. They were much more likely to go through some sort of devastating life event, a job loss or a family status change that would result in a dramatic drop in their household income. And awareness of this fact led some people with the very best of intentions to say, well, one way we can help people who go through these shocks to their income is to allow them to borrow more easily. For example, let them refinance their house and draw some of the equity out of their house. And that's okay because housing prices aren't going to go down. The Federal Reserve has made sure that won't happen. And so we sort of saw how that resulted. And I don't make judge. It's difficult for us to stand back and say that was the wrong call because we were trying to overcome a problem there. I think in the last 7 or 8 years, we've, in some sense, swung too far in the other direction. The home ownership rate has dropped from 69% to 64%, 65%.
Because banks are tightened up, you're saying.
It's actually become harder to get a house. And the people who are least likely to qualify for a house are those people on lower to middle incomes who used to need that help getting into a house. And the odds are that a lot of those people would have been very successful homeowners. What I would sort of plead for is, once again, sort of an intelligent and grown-up approach to this. Can we find a way to allow some risk to happen? Because everybody who buys a house is taking some risk. Every bank that extends a loan to that person is taking some risk. Can we allow that level of background risk-taking, which makes us more prosperous in the long run, take place without allowing so much aggregate hidden risk to build up in the system that it creates a crisis? And I'm convinced that that is possible to do. I would like to see the financial system and the regulatory system enable banks to ensure that they have enough capital that they're not going to be brought down by an accident or some stupid mistake, but to also not discourage them from lending money to people who in the long run will be good risks.
It goes all the way from football and football helmets to finance. Peggy in Warrens, Wisconsin. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, this is more personal, I think, but this generation seems to be raised with this pretense that we can eliminate all the risk, and it seems very dangerous to me. I was raised 50 years ago in rural Wisconsin, and we literally were told by our parents and grandparents, you know, children who panic survive, children who panic die, children who think survive. And I just don't see that in this generation. They have
this. You mean a younger generation, Peggy?
Yeah, my son is 17, but I'm about 20 years older than most of his friends' parents. And yeah, that's what I'm seeing. They're prepared for these virtual risks that they see on the news, but they're not prepared for anything in real life that might come up. They don't seem to have coping skills, and I think that's because we're feeding them this myth that they can eliminate risk. You know, if you wear your helmet and you do this and you do that. And sometimes risk just is there and you have to deal with it. And I don't think they're being prepared to.
Peggy, I appreciate your call. Tom Herschel, do you see that as a sociologist, a generational difference in our perception or understanding of risk?
Well, what I see happening, especially on campus, is a lot of students are taking a lot of indebtedness to get to college. And they feel that there's a very high risk of you know, not being able to be in a good financial situation after they graduate, given the risk and given the labor market. So, yeah, I think there's actually a lot of trepidation about that particular risk.
A lot of cross currents here, maybe a sense of invulnerability, but then vulnerability at the same time. Greg Ipp is talking about it in his new book, Foolproof. Tom Herschel looks at Chasing the American Dream, co-authored there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Chief Economics Commentator at the Wall Street Journal, Greg Ipp, about his new book, Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe, looking at the ways in which some efforts to reduce risk can actually produce more It gets relevant in political and policy terms in a big hurry these days. He takes it all the way from football helmets to high finance. Joins us from New York today. Tom Herschel is with us as well, professor of sociology at Cornell, co-author of Chasing the American Dream with Mark Robert Rank and Kirk Foster. Just last night, lots of conversation, a fair bit, at the Democratic debate in Las Vegas about what to do on the finance front. We had Martin O'Malley, one of the candidates there, going for the Democratic nomination, saying it's time to bring back more control in banking, the Glass-Steagall Act in particular. Here's O'Malley.
Something happened in between, and that is, Anderson, a Wall Street crash that wiped out millions of jobs and millions in of savings for families, and we are still just as vulnerable, Paul Volcker says today. We need to reinstate Glass-Steagall, and that's a huge difference on this stage.
Bring back that wall of safety, Glass-Steagall. Dave in Stowe, Massachusetts, you're on with Greg Ipp. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks very much for the conversation. I just wanted to say that regarding risk, I think it's really dangerous to take the analogy too far.
Which analogy, Dave?
The analogy that, to use the example of risk in itself as being dangerous, if you apply certain risks, of course, are certain attempts to mitigate risk result in more risk. There's no doubt about that. But you've got to look at every situation. For example, what you just spoke about of the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yeah.
It's fine if you take risks with your own money, and it's fine if you take risks by yourself. But to take risks with society's economic system is unconscionable. It's not allowable. Another example, I heard your guest talk earlier about nuclear power as being a solution to climate change. I work in energy conservation and renewable energy, and in fact, if your guest is interested in studying, researching information, the fact of the matter is, no matter what you think about nuclear power, it is simply too darn expensive, and our economic system, were it working, would be pushing us extremely, energy conservation is by and large the best way to resolve energy problems, and renewable energy can and is more and more, as we see, it's getting cheaper and cheaper, and pretty soon we're going to have storage. So I just want to not get too excited about the idea of risk simply being avoiding risk just being a bad thing to do.
Yeah, Dave, I appreciate your call. Greg Ipp, Neil writes to us, banking systems are totally different than wildfires. They're not equivalent. They require different responses. What about? Martin O'Malley says bring back Glass-Steagall. You hear our caller, Dave, he says don't be too warm to risk. And then Neil saying don't compare it too easily with the wildfire front. What about the finance? And what, I mean, you're at the Wall Street Journal. You write about economics. Where did you finally come down on that front?
So I think the point about Glass-Steagall is an interesting one. If you think about it, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers were both investment banks. They weren't the product of mergers between commercial banks and investment banks.
So Glass-Steagall would not have applied to them.
Correct, correct. I think the bigger issue you had with both those firms is that they were so large and so interconnected with the rest of the financial system. In one case, the government couldn't let Bear Stearns fail and they stepped in. In the second, they felt they had no choice and allowed Lehman to fail, and it brought about all sorts of chaos. And I think that one of the bits of unfinished business, although we've made progress, is trying to ensure that we don't have any longer too big to fail banks. And this is where I think a lot of the advocates of increased regulation are exactly right. History and evidence and experience tells us that the bigger and more interconnected these banks become, the more of a menace they are to the financial system, and the tougher it is for a government to actually allow market forces to take their take the right path and allow such institution to fail. So we need a regulatory framework that takes away the presumption that they will be saved, that takes away, in effect, the taxpayer subsidy for these large, very large banks. That can be done a couple ways. One is to require a bank, as it gets bigger, to hold more capital, which is very expensive. It makes banking less profitable, but makes it less likely it will fail and need to be bailed out. The other thing, and this is part of the new Dodd-Frank law, is that we need a framework that can allow these banks to be put into bankruptcy if possible and to be closed down without the government stepping in and using taxpayer money. We haven't seen that used yet. It's a brand new law. There's a lot of nervousness about whether it will work, but I think it's definitely a step in the direction to making, to providing us with a financial system that allows, as I like to say, small failures, small disasters, to create resilience in this system so that we do not have complacency and fragility that gives us big disasters.
But, now, you write in Foolproof, if I may, just before we leave that, you write that past moves, which there have been, to require banks to hold more capital, ended up seeing capital move away and end up in riskier investments than it had before.
Yeah, yeah. And so I sit here and I'm going to admit right off the bat, I do not have the complete perfect answer, because that will be an issue, is that we have to keep our eyes peeled for the migration of those risks into other corners of the financial system. And it's something that preoccupies people a lot. And Tom, I'd be lying if I said I had the perfect answer here. But I think that we've gotten part of the way towards the answer. But can I make a second point here?
Yeah.
Because we've talked a lot about how the feeling of safety can actually have the unintended consequence of creating more risk. But there's another part of my story here, which is how the awareness of danger also makes us safer. And I want to tell you a good news story, which is aviation. Aviation is astonishingly safe. It is very well regulated. A Massachusetts resident is 2.5 times as likely to win the jackpot in megabucks, as to perish getting on the next flight. Why is aviation so safe? Partly it's because from the earliest days, the public and the regulators and the airline companies themselves felt that flying was so dangerous that if they didn't make it really safe, people would not fly. And there's been a concerted effort by intelligent regulation, well-done, committed government, and a usually cooperative industry to take every accident that happens in aviation and use that as a lesson to actually make it safer. If I could, for one second, there's a very interesting little organization that I learned about while researching this book called the Aviation Safety Reporting System. They're a branch of NASA. And essentially, they act as a collection point for near-miss reports. Air traffic controllers and pilots will report to this organization about how they almost came close to an accident but didn't quite have an accident. And this organization will then publish these stories for everybody to read. And they're kind of hair-raising if you actually read them. They're all out there on the internet. But the effect of sharing these near-miss stories is to make everybody in the industry, the controllers, the regulators, and the pilots, aware of the risks that are out there and to act in a cautious way. There's a saying in the disaster and safety research industry that sometimes you want to be a little bit scared, not really scared so that you can't move or do anything, but a little bit scared so that you're always aware of what's out there. And the awareness of that risk will create an attitude or a more precautionary behavior. So I put forth aviation. There's a chapter in the book that talks a lot about that as essentially a positive good news story about how we can actually make things safer without actually having these unintended consequences.
Our attitudes on safety and risk always operating in some way as a kind of guidance system, personally or in terms of national policy. Christian in Carlisle, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was calling to address the issue of perceived childhood risk. Last week I read in the newspaper they had a police log, and the police were called to respond to a caller who had seen two children between the ages of 9 and 11 riding their bicycles unattended on the road. And I remarked how strange that was, because growing up, I spent so much time riding my bicycle.
It sounds like all of my childhood, Christian. Yeah,
exactly. But now that's actually considered a very risky behavior that someone needs to intervene to protect these children. And I was just wondering, what happens when children are so protected? What is their perception of risk as they grow into adulthood? And does that change their tolerance of risk, given the way that they've been parented?
And ultimately,
early in their life?
Ultimately, even perhaps how our politics play out. Tom Herschel, what about it over time, perceptions of risk in different generations? How do you see it?
Well, I think the continuity we find in our book is that Americans want to feel optimistic, and I think that's sort of the bottom line. They want to feel optimistic about their lives and about their families and about their friends, and so that probably has changed over time, where you have more, people have more controls on their lives, and so they're willing to accept that. But I don't really know if that's a good thing or a bad thing that people called up about these children.
Well, I mean, it the children were out there riding, but somehow the attitude got out that that's too risky. If the kids absorb that, I don't know what that means about social change, about their willingness to step up and take risks in the face of opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, they probably feel like they're protecting their neighbor's children. So maybe that's a positive thing. Maybe it's not. You know, sometimes people overstep boundaries sometimes.
Though that's become a kind of common meme. I want to get one more call on that front, Greg, and I'll bring it to you. Christian, sure. I appreciate your call. John in Miami, Florida. John, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for talking about this topic. I think it's so interesting. And what really interested me was the mention of energy and also the banking system. And I would like to, if I may, talk about risk within the context of change. I think most people are afraid of risk, especially when it comes in the form of societal or political changes. And I would like to bring up the example of the internet. When the internet was first brought on board, it was a major change and it really helped our economy. It was a big boost in our economy. However, we do see a lot of stores, such as in my local town, my Best Buy is closing soon. And Best Buy was, it's been a very popular store for a long time, but it's closing soon. And I assume one of the major reasons why is because everyone's shopping on Amazon right now.
Yeah.
Everyone's shopping online.
Okay.
And I would like to compare this situation to the electric car. In the year 2015, it astonishes me that we still are not making huge strides in manufacturing electric cars. And of course, this is happening because a lot of the major car companies don't want to lose money, which is very understandable. They want to stick to their gas cars, and shifting to electric cars is very expensive. They may lose a lot of money. However, no one's thinking about the long term. This is a very short term risk, and it's a change that if we want to save our planet, if we want to leave a healthy, clean planet for our children, our grandchildren, something we must do. And we've done this before. The internet, great economic boost. It caused pain. However, we are seeing the benefits of the internet, and I see the same thing happening with the with good energy and the big strides in clean energy and the electric car industry. And if I may just add, there's one more point. And when it comes to the banking system, I feel that a lot of us as human beings, we tend to forget that we attribute value to symbols that we create. And that symbol, these symbols include something like money. And my biggest example, my best example I could give is the hedge funder, the pharmaceutical hedge funder that was recently in the spotlight for raising the price of, I forgot the name of the
by a gazillion percent. Yeah, what about it? How's it go to risk?
Well, I feel that we forget that, again, that we create value and attribute to these symbols. And when it comes to risk, you know, a lot of us are complaining about how expensive things are, how hard it is to live on the minimum wage. But my question is, why are things expensive? Why are things costing so much? And my answer, my personal opinion, my answer is that there are a group of people, not just in our nation, across the world, that determine how much things are.
John, we got it. I appreciate your call, but you're kind of losing me there on the risk and safety front. I want to dive on in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I mean, Greg, what I do take from that is that people's assessment of risk and how comfortable they are in handling it does speak to their willingness to be open to change and opportunity. Where do you see us on that spectrum?
This is a great question and a really important point. Now, if you look back at the housing bubble, it really was quite destructive. It left a lot of people out of their homes. It did a lot of damage to our economy. But go back a decade earlier to the NASDAQ bubble and ask yourself, did we end up better off or worse off as a result of that NASDAQ bubble? Think of companies like Amazon, which have revolutionized things like retailing or cloud computing. That was a company that lost money for years and arguably would not have grown as much as it did and produced the innovations that it did if it hadn't been for the insanity of the NASDAQ bubble, which made people willing to buy its stocks and bonds. And not just Amazon, but for example, there was billions of miles of fiber optic, effectively many, many miles of fiber optic cable laid by companies that were getting cheap financing because there was a bubble going on. But that fiber optic capacity has made possible all sorts of new innovative services, such as cloud computing, such as Facebook. So the question then becomes, most of us know at some level that a market economy like ours in the long run thrives because some entrepreneurs go out there with a crazy idea, you know, whether it's to start Starbucks or whether it's to start a dry cleaner on the corner. And a lot of those ideas fail, but a lot of them work out and it's great for the jobs they create and the innovations they produce. But then a lot of people end up suffering in the end, like the caller said. when Amazon thrives, a lot of brick-and-mortar retailers suffer. So what we as a society, I'm convinced we need, is to make sure that there is a safety net that gives people the courage to take some risks that we know will make us better off in the long run. To give you one very simple example, one of the unique features of the U.S. for a long time is that healthcare is intimately tied to your employer. Most people get their healthcare through their employer. That makes them often reluctant to change jobs or perhaps go into business for themselves and start a new company because they'll lose their health care. One of the potential benefits of the Affordable Care Act is that it weakens that link and enables more people to find health care without being tied to a particular job. It is possible that by creating a sort of a substrata or a foundation of safety around individuals' decisions, it will embolden them to take the kinds of risks that may not always work out. But in the long run, if enough people, you know, try to innovate or start a new business, it will be good for the economy in the long run.
Cuts both ways when it comes to safety and risk. I guess the right balance is the issue. How do we find it? Where do we find it? Greg Ipp's new book is Foolproof, Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. All in the right portions. Greg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Tom Herschel, co-author of Chasing the American Dream, professor of sociology at Cornell University. Thomas Herschel, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.